Right, so the title of the paper is Objectivity, Reality, and the In Itself, From Deflationary to Transcendental Realism. So, the object of realist metaphysics is generally thought to describe the structure of the world as it is in itself, or, alternatively, to determine precisely what is real. The purpose of this paper is to suggest that, although there have been many attempts to achieve this goal, they all fall down, not simply because they have misconstrued the nature of the in itself, or precisely what is real, but because, more fundamentally, they are not clear about what it is to talk about the in itself, or the real. In short, contemporary realism, both continental and analytic, does not have an adequate concept of reality. To demonstrate this point, I'm going to rehearse a couple different dialectics between realist and non-realist positions in order to tease out their inherent problems. I will first tackle Quentin Melissieu's reconstructed dialectic of correlationism, and then examine several different debates within analytic metaphysics that exhibit the same dialectical structure, within which I will locate what I term deflationary realism. I will then bring together the various considerations that have arisen to show how we can move from deflationary realism to a properly transcendental realism, in which the task of realist metaphysics is made properly explicit. So, first of all, I'm going to briefly introduce the classical dialectic between realism and idealism, and show where what Melissieu calls correlationism stands in relation to it. To this end, I'm going to introduce a series of definitions, and these are the first three definitions on your handout. First of all, classical realism. This is any position that takes there to be a real structure of the world that is ontologically independent and thus distinct from the structure of thought. This position is exemplified by thinkers such as Aristotle and Locke. Then there's classical idealism, the ordinary opponent of this. And that's any position that takes there to be a real structure of the world that is in some sense identical to and thus ontologically dependent upon the structure of thought. This position is exemplified by thinkers such as Berkeley and Hegel. Thirdly, there's the position Melissieu introduces, correlationism. And this is any position which holds that the real structure of the world is to some extent unknowable, insofar as knowledge is always relativized to the subjective conditions of knowledge. For example, to forms of intuition, cultures, or language games, or whatever you want to identify that. What this means is that there is no access to the in itself. There is only ever the in itself for us. This position is exemplified by Kant, Heidegger, and the later Wittgenstein on some interpretations. Right. In the subsequent discussion, we will seek to determine the meaning of three crucial notions that appear within these definitions. Reality, the in itself, and the structure of the world. So, moving on. Melissieu takes it that correlationism defeats both realism and idealism by deploying a different argument against each. Tom's gone through these already to a certain extent. The first is the circle of correlation against realism, and then there's the argument from facticity against idealism. Melissieu takes Fichte's initial account of consciousness in the Wissenschaftslehre to provide the most basic form of the circle of correlation. The definition of Fichtean consciousness is on your sheet. It's very, very simple. For Fichte, the I, or the subject, posits the not-I, or the object, but it posits it as not posited. In essence, consciousness thinks about the object and attempts to think the object as independent of its thinking. However, it ends up in a pragmatic contradiction. The fact that it posits the object contradicts the content it posits, namely, that the object isn't posited. So, Melissieu holds that all forms of classical realism display the same pragmatic contradiction. They try to think the object as it is independent of thought. This is impossible because one cannot have knowledge of anything independently of the subjective conditions of knowledge. One cannot know if the in itself is either the same or different from the way that it appears under these conditions. So, moving on. Classical idealism is immune to the circle of correlation because it absolutizes the correlation itself. It identifies the subjective conditions of knowledge or the structure of thought with what is known, and thereby denies the possibility that the in itself could be different from how it is for us. We thus can know the real structure of the world, because it is the same as the subjective conditions of knowledge or the structure of thought. To refute the idealist, the correlationist needs to shore up the possibility that the in itself can be different from the for us. This is done by insisting on the facticity of thought. This is to say, the existence of thought is taken to be contingent. Given that there must be a real structure of the world, this implies that there can be a world without thought, and thus that they are not identical. Now, Melesu motivates his own neo-realist position by hijacking this argument from facticity. He absolutizes facticity rather than absolutizing the correlation, but I'm not going to go into all of this. I'm instead going to attack his whole definition of correlationism. So there are at least two distinct issues. There was a third, but it's been cut out, with Melesu's presentation of correlationism. First of all, the Fichtean account of thought is ambiguous as to whether thinking X is a matter of thinking a proposition about X, so whether, you know, thinking my mother is thinking that my mother makes nice cakes, or whether it's a matter of grasping the concept of X, whether it's a matter of grasping the concept of my mother. Right? A proposition provides the content of an isolated claim about something, whereas the concept can incorporate a variety of such contents, as long as they are sufficient to individuate the object. So to give another example, it's ambiguous whether thinking mitochondria is a matter of thinking something like mitochondrial DNA is inherited from the mother, or a matter of grasping a series of facts that specify what mitochondria are. Okay. Now, secondly, we can see that the dialectic of correlationism is structured around two different questions about dependence upon the structure of thought. Right? On the one hand, there is the question of whether the in itself is ontologically dependent upon the structure of thought. This is the primary dimension of the debate between classical realism and classical idealism. Correlationism sides with realism on this issue. On the other hand, there is the question of whether our knowledge of the in itself is epistemically dependent on the structure of thought. This is the debate over whether we can know anything absolutely, or whether all knowledge is relative. Now, correlationism obviously sides with relativism on this issue. The crucial point is that the correlationist makes the following assumption. And this should have been on the handout, but it's not. So if you want to write it down, feel free. This is what I call the sufficiency thesis, right? And this is that the ontological dependence of the in itself from thought is sufficient to establish the possibility that the in itself could be different from the way it appears in relation to thought. And thus, that the ontological dependence of the in itself from thought is sufficient to establish epistemic dependence in the way I just defined it. Right. The problem with this thesis is very complicated. To understand it, it's necessary to recognise that the circle of correlation does not tell us how exactly the content of thought is relative to its subjective conditions. In other words, it doesn't explain what the relativity of our knowledge to those subjective conditions consists in. The problem with the sufficiency thesis is that it only holds if it is supplemented by such an explanation. This is even more problematic than it initially appears, because the essential features of thought that such an account would take to be potentially absent in the in itself must be accounted for in ontological terms. In essence, the correlationist requires an ontological account of thought, because only such an account can leverage the ontological fact about the independence of the in itself from thought. The real problem here is that an ontological account of thought would undermine the simplicity and thus the force of the argument from the circle of correlation. It would be a hell of a big assumption in order to underlie the argument. So the real weakness of Melesu's approach is that its understanding of the notion of the in itself, for all that it's supposed to support an epistemological argument, is always implicitly ontological. Okay, so moving on. I'm now going to examine a series of different debates in analytic metaphysics, within which I will uncover the same dialectical structure and use this to introduce a position that has not yet been encountered. which I will call deflationary realism. Unfortunately, I'll have to ignore much of the specific detail of these debates and will present them in a somewhat truncated form. So, whereas the classical debate between realism and idealism is about the real structure of the world as a whole, each of these debates deals with a specific aspect of this structure. I'm not going to explain what that notion of aspect means exactly now, but we might come into it later. So first of all, we're going to tackle a debate about, the first debate is a disagreement over whether a particular domain of entities exists, or whether this particular domain of entities is real. I'm going to take numbers as the example because it's the most tried and tested example in the history of philosophy. The debate initially takes place between local realism about number, which is traditionally called Platonism, and local anti-realism about number, traditionally called nominalism. Both are forms of classical realism, insofar as both take there to be a real structure of the world independent of thought, and both hold that there are some domains of entities that are real, and thus a part of this structure. For instance, they both tend to think that physical objects are real. The difference is that the Platonist thinks that numbers are just as real as tables and chairs and podiums and whatever we're looking at the time, whereas the nominalist thinks they're not. The deflationary realist steps into this debate and opposes both forms of classical realism. In this instance, the deflationist is none other than Quine. Quine holds that there is no more to existence than existential quantification, and that there is no notion of reality distinct from existence. In effect, Quine denies that either form of classical realism can actually make any sense of what they mean by real. The major consequence of Quine's view is that all ontological questions about whether or not a given domain of entities exists, or is real, become trivial questions about whether we take there to be true statements which quantify over that domain. So, for instance, if we take it to be true that there are infinitely many prime numbers, we are thereby committed to the existence both of numbers and prime numbers more specifically. Okay. In essence, if we take that to be true mathematical statements, then we're committed to the existence of mathematical objects, and that's it. So we can translate Quine's idea as follows, and I've got this down on the sheet, it's the Quine thesis. And this is that there is no thick notion of reality for entities, but only a thin one. An entity is real in this thin sense, if and only if we take there to be something true of it. Okay, now let's move on to the second debate. This is a disagreement over whether certain kinds of predicates pick out real properties. The predicates in question are values such as good, beautiful, funny, and whatnot. In this debate, Simon Blackburn plays the role of the local anti-realist. He opposes his position, which he calls quasi-realism about value, to what he calls naive realism about value, which is the corresponding local realism. The naive realist supposedly holds that entities in the world are really imbued of values, independently of the way we take them to be. This means that a sunset could be beautiful even if sentient creatures had never evolved, in just the same sense that it would still last the same amount of time even if no systems of time measurement had ever been developed. Blackburn thinks that the properties studied by the natural sciences are real properties and that values are... Blackburn's position is opposed to this. Blackburn thinks that only the properties of the natural sciences are real, whereas values are just kind of pseudo-predicates. He holds that values are instead projected onto the world by us, rather than being there independently of us. Now, the deflationary realist in this debate is John McDowell. He classifies his position as anti-anti-realism. So it's very much deflationism in the way I'm putting forward. The crux of the debate between McDowell and Blackburn is whether or not statements which predicate values of objects can be true or false, or truth-apt, Tom mentioned. Blackburn denies this by showing how the ways we identify and argue about values fall short of the paradigm case, which is properties studied by the natural sciences. In response to this, McDowell has a series of arguments. But the important point that I'm going to take from is that even if value discourse can never have the form of natural scientific discourse, it nonetheless displays all the features characteristic of assessing the truth and falsity of claims. In essence, McDowell establishes a set of deflationary standards for what kind of discourse counts as truth, as able to be true or false. And then he denies that there is anything more to the reality of properties than there being true claims about them. On this basis, we can create a parallel at the Quine thesis, and this is on the handout again, which is the McDowell thesis. There are only thin notions of both reality and truth. A property is real if and only if we take some ascriptions of it to be true in the thin sense. Right. The third debate is harder to classify than the first two. It regards the reality of possibility and necessity. The problem with classifying this is that although this it can potentially be interpreted as a debate about whether or not a certain kind of entity exists, namely possible worlds, or whether there are real modal properties such as dispositions, it is really a more general debate than this. This can be demonstrated by considering two different versions of the debate, one between David Lewis and Simon Blackburn, and one between Hugh Price and Robert Brandom, and these are pretty much parallel. Taking the former debate as the sort of primary one, Blackburn initially attacks Lewis, who is famous for advocating the reality of possible worlds. He thinks that possible worlds are real in just the same sense as the actual world is real, as if he occupies the local realist position. So as if he's sort of strongly saying, yes, possible worlds are strongly real, just like the actual world is strongly real. However, Lewis's response to Blackburn reveals that he's in fact a deflationary realist. In effect, he accuses Blackburn of ascribing a thick notion of reality to the actual that he denies to the possible. By contrast, Lewis is not claiming that possible worlds are real in the thick sense, but deploying a uniformly thin sense of reality on which the possible and the actual are on equal footing. Lewis argues that we take modal claims to be true, and that we must thereby commit ourselves to the existence or reality of whatever is required to properly interpret their truth. This means that we are committed to the reality of whatever elements we use to interpret the semantics of modal claims. For David Lewis, this means the existence of possible worlds. The debate between Price and Brandom is pretty much parallel to this, but the main difference is that Brandom takes incompatibility relations between propositions. So, you know, it's incompatible but that my phone is here and in Madrid, as his semantic primitives. And thus, he's not committed to the reality of possible worlds, but rather to the reality of incompatibilities. What comes out of this fact is that there can be aspects of the world not straightforwardly reducible to questions about entities and their properties, or at least it's not obvious that all aspects of the world have to be understood in terms of questions of the reality of entities or properties. So we can translate the basic ideas of Lewis and Brandom as follows, and this is on the sheet as the Lewis-Brandom thesis. One, there is only a thin notion of reality with respect to aspects of the world, and secondly, an aspect of the world is real in this sense if we take that to be true claims about it. Finally, the nature of this aspect is determined by the semantics of those claims. That's quite important. Right. Now that we've had a look at the way deflationary realism functions within local debates, we can try to work out the general character of the position. An important point to make is that it is not possible to be a deflationist in one debate and not another. This is because the deflationist's tactic is to replace the thick notion of reality with a thin one. And it is the same notion which is deployed in all these debates. If one is a deflationary realist, this means one must be a global deflationary realist. Reality has got to be thin, whatever you're talking about. I think we can pick out three essential insights of deflationary realism from the debates just considered. Firstly, from the Quine thesis, that there's a crucial link between a thin notion of reality and the notion of truth. Secondly, from the McDowell thesis, that to be genuinely deflationary, the notion of truth must itself be equally thin. Thirdly, and this is what we get from the debate between the Brandom and Lewis point, the structure of the world is reflected by the semantics of our truth claims. And what this means is that the structure of the world is reflected by the structure of our thought and talk about it. Now, this sounds a bit like idealism, but it's not, in an important sense, and I'm going to show why. Now, just because all of the deflationary realists discussed above should have a coherently articulated global deflationist position doesn't mean that they actually do. The exception is Brandom, who articulates a systematic position that incorporates all three insights just discussed. So, Brandom does this by explicitly addressing the question of the dependency of the structure of the world on the structure of thought. And the important point is that he articulates a dependency thesis which is not ontological. And that means that that's why it doesn't collapse into classical idealism. I mean, Brandom actually makes this point as an interpretation of Hegel. So he takes this to be what classical idealism is actually doing, but I think he's wrong about that. Anyway, to do this, Brandom introduces the notions of sense dependency and reference dependency. And these are on your sheet as well. So a sense dependency, the definition is a concept P is sense dependent on a concept Q, just in case one cannot count as having grasped P unless one counts as grasping Q. Whereas P is reference dependent on Q, just in case P cannot apply to something unless Q also applies to it. So, in short, P is sense dependent on Q if one cannot understand P without understanding Q, and reference dependent upon Q if there cannot be P without there being Q. The former is a kind of epistemic dependence, whereas the latter is a kind of ontological dependence. Now, Brandom points out that there can be sense dependence without reference dependence. So, for example, one can't understand the concept nail without understanding the concept hammer. You can't understand nails without understanding hammers. But we could, theoretically, destroy all hammers in existence and the nails would still be around. We can thus articulate Brandom's position as follows. One, for Brandom, the world is all that is the case, or the totality of what is true. This is just the same definition that Wittgenstein gives at the beginning of the Tractatus. Secondly, thought is just the rational process through which we update and revise what we take to be true, i.e. through which we update and revise our picture of the world. Thirdly, and this is the important one, the concept of world is reciprocally sense-dependent upon the concept of thought. One cannot understand the structure of the world without understanding the structure of the rational process through which we update our picture of the world. Or, importantly, vice versa. This allows Brandom to make various claims about the structure of the world, but I'm going to skip all that. And we're just going to go straight to the definition of deflationary realism, which we can take from this. So this is also on the sheet. Deflationary realism is any position which denies that there's a thick sense of reality and which holds that the structure of the world and the structure of thought are reciprocally sense-dependent without being reference-dependent. I've thus shown that it's possible to have a position between classical realism and classical idealism that's not correlationism. Moreover, the possibility of this position tells against the sufficiency thesis that the correlationist argument depends upon. This is because the deflationist can accept that the world is ontologically independent from thought, and thus that there could be a world without there being thought. In short, the deflationist can accept facticity and still hold that the structure of the world is dependent upon the structure of thought, albeit in a reciprocal fashion. Right, this means that deflationism trumps correlationism. Okay, right, 10 minutes left. Right, here's an argument for transcendental realism. Deflationary realism is an impressive position, especially when it is explicitly articulated as Brandom does. However, I don't think it's right. There are a variety of reasons for this, but the simplest is that we seem to have an intuitive grasp of a genuinely thick notion of reality. This is obvious when we look at the debate between Platonism and nominalism. We have a good understanding of the difference between the positions. The problem is simply that no one has managed to make explicit the role that the term real is playing in the debate. This is what lets the deflationist claim that the argument makes no sense. The task before us, then, is to explicitly define a thick notion of reality. However, in doing so, we must also avoid defining reality in ontological terms. This is because the notion of reality is actually supposed to make sense of what ontology is, not vice versa. The only way to do this is to define reality in epistemological terms. This means providing a non-ontological account of the structure of thought, something like correlationism, well, at least Melosu can't do. And then showing that this structure incorporates a thick notion of reality within itself, so that the notion of reality is implicit within the structure of thought. I take this to be the essence of a genuinely transcendental approach to realism. I will thus define transcendental realism as follows, and this is on your handout as well. So transcendental realism is any position that shows that the structure of thought itself implies that there is a real structure of the world in excess of the structure of thought. It's important to note that this position is actually a development of deflationary realism rather than a simple return to classical realism. This can be seen if we look at the dependence relations this definition implies. So, for transcendental realism, the structure of the world is sense-dependent upon the structure of thought. But this is not a reciprocal dependence. This looks slightly strange until you realise that understanding the structure of thought is a necessary but not sufficient condition of understanding the structure of the world. So, in short, one must understand the structure of thought in order to understand what it would be to give a proper account of the real structure of the world. This is what Kant would call the critique of metaphysics, which is supposed to come before metaphysics itself. Nonetheless, metaphysics is still something which is independent of this critique. So there's more to the world than the structure of thought. But in order to understand that, we've got to understand the structure of thought. Right. Now, here's the outlines of an argument for a transcendental realist position. I'm going to start by sketching an alternative account of thought to the one Melosu provides. The account of thought I'm going to present is based on the historical successor to Fichte's account of consciousness, namely Hegel's account of natural consciousness and the phenomenology of spirit. This should be on page 2 or page 3 of the handout, and it's in more detail than everything else, because it's quite important. Hegel's account is almost as simple as the Fichtean one we considered earlier. It posits two basic features of consciousness. Firstly, consciousness relates itself to its object, or it takes its object to be a certain way. What this means is just that consciousness makes a claim about its object. Secondly, consciousness distinguishes between its relating, or its claim, and the object as it is in itself. In essence, consciousness allows for the possibility of error. It allows that the object could be different from the way it takes it to be. Right. These two fairly simple features of consciousness have two further implications, which is where everything gets complicated and interesting. Three, because it's consciousness itself that makes the distinction between its claim and the object it is about, the object cannot be truly in itself, but must be for consciousness. This means that consciousness must have a concept of its object. However, consciousness cannot be aware that the object is for it without ceasing to be consciousness, and thus must suppress the fact that the object is for it. What this means is that consciousness cannot recognise the concept of the object is dependent upon it without undermining the very possibility of error that it just set up. So, the first thing to recognise about this definition is that it resolves the proposition-concept ambiguity of the Fichtean approach, which I posed earlier, by having a rule both for propositional claims about objects, which is seen in 1 and 2, and for concepts of objects, which is seen in 3 and 4. The next thing to note is that Hegel has effectively split Fichte's notion of positing as not posited into two distinct subjective acts. I will call these withdrawing authority, which is what's going on in 2, and suppressing the concept, which is what's going on in 4. Withdrawing authority is just a different way of talking about the way that consciousness opens up the possibility of error. The reason I'm using this term is that granting authority to the object over whether one's claim is correct can also be viewed as a matter of withdrawing one's own authority over those claims. So withdrawing one's own authority to stipulate whether one's claims are correct or not. In doing so, one thereby undertakes responsibility to provide reasons why one's claims are correct if challenged. What this means, essentially, is that all claims are open to debate. In contrast to this, the content of concepts is not always open to debate. This is because mutual grasp of a concept is a condition of the possibility of disagreement about anything. For example, we can only have a genuine argument about whether Bill Clinton is a ladies' man if we both understand who Bill Clinton is and what being a ladies' man entails. The point is that in order to open up the possibility of error, we must nonetheless exclude some things from the resulting debate. We must not argue about who Bill Clinton is and what it is to be a ladies' man in order to argue about whether he's a ladies' man. So, while we accept the possible difference between our claim and the object in itself, we suppress the possible difference between our concept of the object and the object. Right. This account of the basic structure of thought gives us the resources to properly articulate epistemic dependence in a non-ontological manner. We can do this by distinguishing between two different ways of understanding the notion of the in itself. Firstly, in terms of mind independence, and secondly, in terms of attitude independence. Both of these definitions are on your sheet. For mind independence, something is in itself if it can exist independently of the existence of minds. This is the definition Melosuk takes, right? Alternatively, attitude independence account, something is in itself if the way it is independent of the way we take it to be. The former is an ontological understanding, whereas the latter is non-ontological. The Hegelian account of thought I just provided enables us to adopt the latter attitude independence account. But we can see that what I've called the withdrawal of authority is just a matter of establishing this attitude independence. Now, here's an interesting thing. On this basis, we can reformulate the correlationist intuition in far more exacting terms. So here's the correlationist intuition, and this is on your sheet as well. The suppression of the concept prevents us from ever establishing the absolute attitude independence of the object of representation. This means that whether or not our claims about the object are true is never completely up to the object, but is always mediated by something that we, either as individuals or as a community, have authority over. So the idea is that because we, I mean both me and the community, determine our concepts, that prevents us from ever getting at the objects as they are in themselves, because that authority of ours is always mediating. Right. Here's how we get past this problem. Let us call absolute attitude independence objectivity. For a claim to be objectively assessable is for its truth to be independent of any attitudes that anyone ever has or will have. This means that no claims about anyone's attitudes can count as good reasons for taking it to be true. The correlationist intuition can then be understood as the claim that we are unable to objectively assess the truth of any claim. Now, it's important to note that some truth claims are obviously not objectively assessable in this way. For instance, the claim Harry Potter is a wizard, right, is not assessable independently of our attitudes about Harry Potter. And more extremely, Harry Potter has a secret half-sister. We'd like to say that J.K. Rowling has some special form of authority over whether or not that is true or not. So it's obviously that the case that there are some non-objectively assessable claims, and that in these cases what we have is something like relative attitude independence. Because me and you can argue about whether or not Harry Potter has a secret half-sister, and we can give up our own authority over whether that's the case. But we can't take it away from J.K. Rowling. Okay. What this indicates is that in contrast to deflationary realism, which holds that there's only a single thin notion of truth, there's at least two thick notions of truth. objective and non-objective truth. And this gives us the leverage to overcome deflationism, but only if we can fight off the correlationist challenge to objectivity. Right, there's still some stuff to go, and I realise I'm out of time, so I'm going to go as quickly as possible, but we should get to the punchline, hopefully. Right, so the key to this is to understand that our concepts aren't fixed, but are revisable, and that because the world itself can sometimes force us to revise our concepts, this makes the assessment of those concepts independent of our attitudes in a principled way. First, it is important to recognise that the suppression of the concept isn't irrevocable. It is possible for us to argue about the content of our concepts, so who Bill Clinton is or what it is to be a ladies' man, but doing so suspends the debates for which those concepts are a condition. In short, we always perform a suspension of representation in order to examine the conditions of representation. The important point is that we can never perform a global suspension, but only a local, but only local suspensions. This is just to say that if we disagreed about everything, we couldn't actually agree. We couldn't disagree about anything. Say that again. If we disagreed about everything, we couldn't disagree about anything. Or, if we examine some concepts, we always have to use others to do so. Right. Secondly, we have to distinguish between two different kinds of claim, and these are on the sheet. This is under objectivity, I think. Firstly, there's objectual commitments, which are claims about specific objects. So, this liquid tastes sour, or that ball's red, or whatever. Or, my other example, everyone in this room has excellent taste in philosophy. And secondly, there are inferential commitments, which are claims which make explicit inferential rules which constitute the content of predicate concepts. So, I'll give more examples because I've got the argument coming up, right? What we can then show is that we can be forced to revise the inferential rules which constitute the content of our concepts on the basis of objectual commitments. So, if we take the above example of the concept acid, right, which we will take to be constituted by two rules. If something tastes sour, then it's an acid, and if something is an acid, then it turns litmus paper red. If, in observation, we then acquire objectual commitments of the form this liquid tastes sour and it turns litmus paper blue, then it contradicts our concept. This means that we can be forced to revise our concept by abandoning or modifying one or more of these rules. The crucial insight, then, is that although we can never completely withdraw authority in any given debate, or that we cannot perform a global suspension of representation, there is a subset of our truth claims in which there is nothing for which we cannot perform a local suspension, and thus bring it into question. This is just the set of objective truth claims. It is possible that importantly, it's possible that upon performing a suspension, so upon bringing some concepts into question, we will find that our argument bottoms out, either because it must appeal to the authority of some group or individual, as in the J.K. Rowling case, or because it's not possible to make the claim without some kind of pragmatic contradiction. In those cases, we say that these claims are non-objective. In the first case, they are what I'd call interpretational claims, rather than descriptive claims. And in the second case, they're transcendental claims. Or if you want to be a bit more, even more Kantian, you'd say they're synthetic a priori claims. Now, moreover, because we allow the possibility of suspending representation by default, this means that the ideal of objectivity itself is implicit within the very structure of truth. This means that the structure of thought implies that there is a way the world is in itself. Now, that's not yet transcendental realism as I defined it. And here's the final, very short argument for transcendental realism as I defined it. This only holds that there is a way the world is, but not a real structure of the world in itself. We can agree with Brandom that the world is the totality of what is true, and that our picture of the world is just those claims that we take to be true. However, because we've provided a purely formal account of the distinction between objective and non-objective truth, we can now draw a distinction between what I will call the world and the real, which is just the totality of what is objectively true, which is, of course, a subset of what is true. We can then distinguish between the formal structure of the real, which is just the structure of thought about objective matters of fact, and the real structure of the real, which is the structure of the world as it is in itself. The former is a transcendental and thus non-objective matter, whereas the latter is properly objective. The former is the object of the critique of metaphysics, whereas the latter is the object of metaphysics itself. We can then say that because the ideal of objectivity is a part of the structure of truth as such, that we are compelled to move from the formal structure of the real to the real structure of the real. In short, the structure of thought itself implies that there is a real structure of the world which is independent of and in excess of the structure of thought. This is the essence of transcendental realism. That's it.